That's how he began the set. Then he threw in his catchphrase, which never failed to crack up a Philadelphia audience. Dick suck anything. Next thing you knew, the toughest looking gangster of the group stood up, said, "Hey man, get out of here." Threw his drink in Buck's face, drenching him with alcohol and ice cubes. Did they just do what I think they just did? That's why I stuttered the spank. Oh, they done did what you think they just did, and they about to do more. I couldn't believe what just happened. The stage was a sacred barrier, and just in case someone did get rowdy, there was a security guard in the club. His name was Brother Carlton. Where the fuck was he at? Buck Wild took his glasses off. Then after that, he brought them to his shirt and started cleaning them slowly, as if he was in a daze. I'd never seen Buck do anything slowly in my life. When he was done, he mumbled, "Salam alaikum, I..." That's what he said into the microphone. He kept repeating it like it was a magic spell to cast peace over the club. "I'm saying salam alaikum, brothers." He got his glasses back on and made one last attempt to pacify them. Mentioning the neighborhood he was from, their response was, "We know where you at. We know your block. Get out of here, motherfucker." And that motherfucker got out of here. He was done. Ture scrambled back to the stage and worked up all his confidence to tell them, "Hey, y'all gotta calm down and let these comics perform." They proceeded to tell Ture that they knew who he was and exactly where he lived, too. Brother Carlton leaped into action. He was 20 minutes late in leaping, but at least he was going to finally take care of this and get him out of here. He walked to the front table, bent down, started talking to these guys in a low whisper. Every now and then, he'd clap one of them on the back and say, "That's all I'm saying, all right? Come on, man. Y'all know how it is." Even from the back of the room, I knew what was going on. He was pretending like he was doing something. He wasn't saying shit, other than talking to them like they were his friends. Nobody was going to get kicked out of that place tonight except the comics. Eventually, Brother Carlton straightened up, walked away, and waved. "Go ahead, Ture, we good." I shook my head in despair. I was up after the next comic, and everyone in the room knew that all Brother Carlton had done was give these guys a free pass to do whatever the fuck they wanted to the remaining performers. The next victim was one of the best in the city, Tommy Too Smooth. He was a true professional, famous for playing different characters on stage, and I knew he'd stick to his set. As he began his first impression, however, the guys in front came up with another move I'd never seen in the comedy club before. "You ain't funny," one of them snarled. "You broke as hell." All of a sudden, whack, dollar bills were flying everywhere on stage as these guys made it rain on Tommy. I looked around for Brother Carlton so I could tell him with my eyes, "I don't know what kind of talk you just had with those guys, but I don't think it worked." However, I couldn't find Brother Carlton's eyes. All I saw was the door of the club closing really quickly. I think he figured, shit, if I'm not inside the club to see what's going on, then I'm not responsible for stopping what's going on. "All right, well, that's my time." That's what Tommy was saying when I turned back around. He quickly gathered as many bills as he could and walked off the stage. At least I got paid for the night. Old Kevin Hart was up next. As soon as Ture announced me, I was grateful I killed off the name Lil' Kev the Bastard, because the hecklers would have been merciless. I wanted the pass. That's all right, I'm good. Move on to the next performer, but my respect in this scene was important to me. I trudged towards the stage like it was an electric chair. As I did, I tried to figure out what to do. I knew I couldn't perform my set because they keep interrupting and making fun of my punchlines. These guys were here to laugh at us, not with us. As I got to the stage, I realized that there was only one thing I could possibly do to survive the situation. And that was to throw out everything I planned and talk about what was going on. I couldn't stop them or befriend them. I got seen others try and fail to do that night. The only thing I could do was what no one else had done. Talk about what it was like to go on stage and perform in front of them. Tell them the truth of my experience, because it was all I had. This has been weird all night, guys. That's how I began. I felt like I was performing for my life. To people who like you, you're in the spotlight. To those who don't, you're at the center of a target. I recall the lesson I learned as a little guy in school, with humor and logic, or even a humorous logic. I mean, you could disarm someone from fighting. "Y'all threw drinks on a dude," I continued. "Y'all threw money on somebody else. The one guy admitted he was a bitch. I'm sitting in the back praying for help from my mama. This can't keep going on and on. For one thing, there's probably a stripper out there who really could have used those dollar bills to pay a rent. So why don't we break the chain right here?" It was the first time I was glad to hear silence in a comedy club, because they were listening to me, because I was speaking to them, not at them. As I grew more comfortable, I began sprinkling in material from past sets that applied directly to the situation. Everything I say up here tonight is a joke, okay? I don't need none of you guys coming up to me after the show talking about, so who's the funny one now? Suddenly I heard quiet, begrudging laughter. The kind that happens when someone keeps their mouth closed and the chuckle escapes through their nose in like a little puff of air. It was the smallest laugh I'd ever got, but it was the biggest relief. In that moment, something broke open inside me, and a wave of calm washed through my body. I became comfortable within my fear. I realized that what these guys had been picking up the whole time was people trying too hard. It was exactly what Keith and Teray had told me I needed to stop doing. And because these guys were predators, trained to sniff out and pounce on the slightest vulnerability, they were more attuned to weakness than even the most discerning comedy crowd. I was surviving this only because for the first time in my short comedy career, I wasn't trying. I was just being. The rest of the set flew by. Everything came out of my mouth effortlessly. I don't like to fight. I get scared real fast. Don't you guys be making those sudden movements. In fact, put your hands on the table so I can see them. It may not have been the funniest set that I'd ever done, but it was one of the best so far. Because I wasn't just playing the role of a scared guy on stage. I was a scared guy on stage. I was telling them they'd won, because that was the only way for me to win. I did get heckled a few times, but I was the only comic who got off stage without being humiliated. It is through our most extreme experiences that the biggest growth happens, if we survive them. That night, I learned how to be vulnerable on stage. Chapter 42, Life of a Baller. Kevin Hart, however, had money problems as usual. Not only was going back and forth to New York with Keith calling me stupid the whole time, starting to wear thin, but I wasn't making money on those nights. Some weeks we drove to the city 5 times. I told Keith that I was performing under my own name and getting better, but I needed more stage time. Still, he wouldn't let Jay and me get on stage in Manhattan. I mean, this meant that I had 1 to 3 free days a week to perform in Philly, and always on off nights, which wasn't enough to earn rent money. I understood then why Teray never wanted to go to New York with me. He had a good setup at home. He had rooms all over the Philly area that brought him good, consistent money. He didn't want to give all that away, because someone would instantly take his place, and he seemed happy where he was. I guess that was the difference between me and many of the people I met over the course of my career. I always wanted to be bigger. I always wanted to do more. I always wanted to find the next step and the step after that. I didn't want to settle like I had in school and on a swim team. This is as true today as it is then. When that envelope with the rent bill for $400 was slipped under my door, I looked at my sock drawer and all I had was $150. I wasn't even close. I didn't have the heart to ask my mom for the money. But between help from Tori, who'd recently been hired to work at Adelphia Cable, and my brother, I managed to make the month's rent. When I paid, I told my landlord that I was working hard to make it as a comedian, and I had gotten a big opportunity to start going to New York. Look, I assure you that once I get a rhythm going, I figure out how to be on time with the rent every month. Fortunately, the landlord was understanding and said, look, he'd give me a little leeway while I got things together. After our next trip to New York, I talked to Big J about it as he drove me back to the house. His solution was, fuck this, man. Let's not go anymore. I said, look, we don't got a choice. If we go back to doing what we were doing before, nothing's going to change. This is at least a way out, man. Once we know some people in New York, maybe we can get on stage without Keith. Yeah, well, good luck with that. I'm tired of it. I'm out. Jay wasn't being callous or cruel. He was just taking care of himself. He was understandably fed up with spending what were sometimes 12-hour days going back and forth to New York like an unpaid chauffeur. But with Jay backing out, I now had 2 problems. No money and no way to get to New York. It is in these moments that you get nostalgic for a day job. At least there's structure, set hours, a predictable paycheck, and a clear path. The following afternoon, Keith called with the usual instructions. Hey, meet me at City Line Avenue at 3 o'clock. I told him, I said, Jay said he's not coming. He said, why not? I said, because he's not getting on stage. He said he wants to get on stage. Didn't I tell him to be patient and trust the process? Well, I guess he don't trust it. Do you trust it? I wasn't sure if I trusted it or not, but it was the only process I had, so I told him yes. Then are you coming today or what? I don't have a way up there. If this is something that you want, figure out a way to City Line Avenue. Find me there, and I'll take you the rest of the way. Okay, I may be a little late on account of having to take the buses there and everything. I'm leaving at 3. If you have City Line Avenue, you can roll with me. If not, I don't know what to tell you, stupid. Bad time for games. Then after that, he hung up on me. I ain't going. I decided on the spot. Then on the next spot, I decided, all right, fuck it, I'm going. I figured out the bus lines, and I got to City Line Avenue shortly before 3. Keith pulled up at 3 sharp, then walked around from the driver's seat to the passenger seat. Evidently, he still expected me to drive him. I'm glad you're serious, he said as he stretched out to sleep. I want you to know that I wouldn't lie to you. You see the way everyone treats me up there? That's because I know what I'm talking about, and I know what I'm doing. They trust me. I'm going to prove that to you today. At Catch a Rising Star, we saw Wanda Sykes before. Afterwards, Keith introduced me to her. Wanda, tell dummy who got you up here. You did. How many times have I cussed you out, Wanda, for not doing what you were supposed to do? A lot of times. Did I ever once lie or mislead you? No. Little dummy here got something, Wanda. But he's stupid. He don't know how to use it. I'm trying to show him how to work it. Wanda then turned to me and spoke to me directly for the first time. Well, shut up and listen, stupid. He knows what he's talking about. As we made the usual circuit, Keith encouraged me to notice details that I previously overlooked. You really are a dummy. You've been coming up here all these weeks and missing the whole point. All these people are coming up in what? They got a piece of paper in their hand. They got a tape recorder on the stool. No, I noticed that. I mean, they're working to get better. No, young fella. These guys are working for the weekend. On Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, they're preparing for the big shows on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. That's where your packed houses are. Until then, everybody's trying to polish their set for the weekend. And they're trying to polish their weekend set so they can get TV spots. They're trying to kill their TV spots so then they can get their own television show. And if you stay ready, you don't ever have to worry about getting ready. I get it. I'm ready. No, dummy. Remember that set that Wanda did? Did you notice how she changed some stuff around at the next show at Caroline's? That's the level of refinement that you need to learn. She knew that if she moved that one line further back, it would get a bigger laugh. And it did. Next time you see her, I guarantee that she keeps it there and adds some more to it. When we saw Wanda do another set of Dangerfields, and she did exactly what Keith had predicted, that's when it hit me like a lightning bolt. I was frustrated before at Keith for constantly telling me I wasn't ready when I believed I was. A firm no is the ugliest sound in the world, and it triggers a defensive response in the brain. Nah, you're wrong. But he was right. I wasn't ready. I still knew nothing about the art of comedy. The problem was not Keith's slowness. It was my impatience. I recognized that I had a lot of work to do to get to that level. Instead of thinking about getting on stage in New York, I needed to think about removing, rewriting, reconstructing, shifting, and shaping every phrase in my set, examining every nuance from my tonality to my gestures. One of the comics who had this perfected was a guy named J.B. Smoove. He was very animated, and before he opened his mouth, audience members already knew that they were going to have a good time and busted up laughing. As I worked to sharpen my act to Philly shows, I tried to hone in on what was naturally funny about me. Keith was relentlessly critical when I asked for feedback. The biggest lesson I learned from him was how to hear a no or a stupid or a get the fuck out of here with that and not take it personal, but instead see that there was a lesson behind it. I don't know why Keith Robinson was the guy that I shut up and listened to, but maybe it was because he was the only person that I met who was as strict and systematic and demanding as my mom. In life, some people can cut through the noise and get through to you in a way that others can't. If you're playing sports, one coach may not reach you, but another will. Or no coach may be able to get through to you, but a teammate will. When it comes to your future, your mother may be telling you exactly what you need to hear, but putting it in a way that makes you disregard her. However, Calvin from two doors down the street says the same thing, and it comes off so simple and helpful that you pay attention to take action. Cultivating the ability to listen to advice that I didn't want to hear, objectively evaluate it, and know when to implement it didn't come naturally to me. I had to learn it the hard way, from someone who was very difficult to listen to. Chapter 43, A Well-Respected Man. Hey, little dummy thinks he should be on stage up here already. It was the end of my first night in New York without Big J, standing awkwardly on the periphery of the table. Keith was introducing me to a comedian I admired. Someone who would become another tough mentor and eventually a good friend and inspiration who was never too shy to say to you what was really on his mind. Patrice O'Neill. Oh, is that what you think? Patrice snapped at me. You got some jokes? Let me hear one of your jokes. Okay, well, why do people get on? Shut up! I don't want to hear your jokes for real. It was a figure of speech. Jesus Christ, Keith. He is dumb. I winced at his words. What you mean? Shut up! Shut up and take it. That's what Keith nudged me. This is what we do, stupid. Tell him to go back home. That's what Patrice said. I can tell he's not funny. Look at his stupid face. He looks like he's about to cry or something. I stood there reeling and then decided not to take Keith's advice. I didn't have to take it. Not when I could throw it back. I ain't stupid, you stupid. I thrust a finger in his face. Look at your teeth. You look like you should be in a rodeo or something. Ha! The new guy attacked back. That's what another comedian at the table yelled. Soon everyone was yelling and talking over each other and snapping on each other. I had no idea what was going on, except that they didn't seem so intimidating anymore. This wasn't the grown-up table. It was a kid's table. Should we let dumb Kev sit at the table with us? That's what Keith asked the group. Nah, keep him at the loser table, Patrice said. I don't want to sit near him. I don't want to see that ugly face of his. He looks like he smells. Keep him over there. Little dummy, sit at that table. Keith ordered. I looked at the table where Big J and I had sat and thought about the prospect of eating there alone, like a lost puppy for 2 hours while these guys were over there having the time of their lives. And I decided, nah, I'm going to sit right here with y'all. Who y'all to tell me where I can sit and where I can't sit? Patrice, shut your fat ass up. You want to talk about smells? You got rolls of fat so big that you got to use deodorant underneath them. Ah, ha, Patrice is fat. That's what another comedian yelled out. Patrice smells. Ah, ha, Patrice smells. Ah, ha, Patrice smells. Ah, ha. They were chanting it. If this was just about being in grade school, oh, I could handle that. I sat at the table and crossed my arms over my chest. I wasn't going anywhere ever again. However, when I tried to join the conversation, they still shut me down. Patrice was like, hey, man, I still need a tag for that joke. I said, what about shut up? Keith said, you're too green. You don't deserve to be a part of these conversations yet. Me? Well, better to be green and old and rusty. Shut up! I made progress, though. Finally. I may have been the greenest comic at the table, but at least I had a new aspiration. It was to become an equal to everyone there. See, Jay never came back to New York with us, but I kept taking the buses to City Line Avenue and driving Keith to New York. Under his tutelage, I began studying the comedians there at an even finer level of detail. Their facial expressions, their intonation, the way they held the mic. I started regularly taping my own shows in Philadelphia and reviewing the performance afterwards for the same subtleties. As the weeks passed, Keith went from introducing me to comedians to introducing me to comedy club owners to helping me prepare for auditions. How you gonna get out of this maze if you don't know if you're in the maze? He kept saying. The first audition he helped me land was at the Boston Comedy Club, which had an urban night on Sundays. I easily passed that. Not because I was so good, but because I was so ready. I had been to the club dozens of times. I knew the audience. I knew the comedians. I knew the waitresses, the bookers, the tables. The lights, every single drink on the menu. I was so comfortable there that it was impossible to fail. Standing on stage at the Boston Comedy Club at the Urban Showcase felt like a major milestone. I was performing in New York City. Keith was right to make me wait so long to perform. I mean, you only get one chance to make a first impression, and it turned out to be a good one, because they asked me back the next week. I often speak about the value of hard work, but hard work is not enough. See, I've seen many people sabotage their careers before it's even started by refusing to do anything unless they're compensated or rewarded directly for it. Or they become bitter, expecting that they'll be rewarded in exchange for just working hard. One of the key factors for success is beyond work, talent, timing, relationships, and all other qualities I've mentioned. It's the glue that holds all these together. It's commitment. What is commitment? Here's what it means to me. Keeping the promises you make to yourself and to others. I promised my mother that I'd figure out a way to survive in comedy. I promised myself that I'd find a road out of Philadelphia onto bigger opportunities. I promised Keith that I'd trust and stick with the process. All three of these promises turned out to be much harder and take much longer to keep than I expected. I still wasn't surviving on my own. I still wasn't getting big opportunities. I still wasn't done with Keith's mentorship. I was still spending over 30 hours a week getting to and from and around New York just for that 5 minutes on stage on Sundays. Though my sleep, time, finances, relationship, even my patience and self-esteem were negatively impacted, and I wanted to quit many times, I remained committed. That's the biggest difference between the amateur and the professional. Between the wannabe and the star. Between the dabbler and the expert. The unsuccessful get halfway to the finish line, then they turn around. The successful get halfway, then they keep going. Both run the same distance, but only one makes it to the finish line. To win a race, then having talent, speed, and endurance help. But those things are nothing without commitment. To commit successfully, you don't have to always believe in yourself. Because let's face it, we all have our doubts at times. But you do have to believe in something higher than yourself. Your purpose. If you believe in your purpose, you can survive the most challenging times. Because God or destiny or your will, or whatever you prefer to believe in, is on your side. If you know it's your purpose to win the race, then you're not going to turn around because there is no other option but to win. And for me, there was no other option besides succeeding in New York. The other comedians would say, get Kev out of here. They tell me to beat it. They tell me I was a hack. They tell me I was never going to make it and I should crawl back home. But I'd never leave. I'd never keep my mouth shut. I was relentless. Even Keith said he'd never seen anyone with this level of focus and drive, which is why he stayed committed to me. I wanted in and I would not stop, no matter how much the older comedians tried to discourage me. I went back and forth to New York for years, studying their style, studying their poise, studying comedians from a generation back, and studying myself until eventually I became one of them. Life lessons from the grind. Without the grind, there is no reward. Think about it. What kind of sex have you ever had that hasn't started with a nice grind? Ha! I'll wait. Chapter 44. Why you should never lend me anything that breaks when it hits a highway median. Eventually, I landed auditions at two more clubs, Stand Up New York and Gotham Comedy Club. I passed them both and was soon performing in New York more regularly. Although I wasn't going up until 1 a.m. sometimes to play what they call food spots. Well, here's the thing. This is what this meant. It meant that instead of getting cash for performing, I got a hamburger and a Coke. Because I now sometimes had gigs in New York when Keith didn't, I begged Tori to let me borrow her 1995 Maxima so I could get up there on my own. However, more food spots in New York meant less paying gigs in Philly. And unfortunately, my landlord wouldn't accept food for rent. Meanwhile, my relationship with Tori was deteriorating. The more she did to help me with my rent and transportation, the less I was around. And the less I was around, the more her family and friends tried to convince her that I was a loser who was using her and giving her nothing in return. It was a fair argument, though in our minds we were making sacrifices for a better tomorrow. When we fought, however, she would throw her friends' criticisms in my face. Admittedly, I was guilty of the same thing she was doing, because friends were putting ideas in my head about the relationship too. During one of our drives to New York, Keith gave me a lecture about priorities. He said that years ago, before he started going to New York regularly, he was in a mall with his girlfriend and rented a movie to watch. They came home, flipped on the television, and happened to see his friend Robin Harris doing comedy. She said, "Why aren't you on television?" Keith thought about her question for a moment and answered, "Honestly, because I'm sitting here with you." His point was that I shouldn't let my relationship get in the way of putting in the extraordinary amount of time and dedication it takes to make it. Being a comedian was like joining the army, he explained. You had to leave home and form a new family with your fellow soldiers. The difference, though, is that soldiers make one choice, to enlist, and then after that they leave home for a certain number of years. Comedy is a choice that must be made every day, and it can feel like you're choosing the clubs over your partner. So, it put a serious strain on my relationship when I'd come back from New York at 4 or 5 a.m, then sleep until 2 the next day, catch the afternoon bus back to Manhattan. One night, it was snowing pretty hard, and I was racing to New York in Tory's Maximum, worried I was going to be late to my show. I didn't want to miss a spot because I might not get another one. In the midst of the storm, I was exiting the highway, the Maxima's wheel hit a patch of ice, and the car spun out and crashed into a concrete barrier. I wasn't injured, but pieces of the car were all over the ramp. The worst damage came later. It was when I told Tori about the accident. Not only was she pissed at me, but her parents were too. They yelled at me for 15 minutes telling me I was a loser and a dropout and the worst thing that ever happened to their daughter's life. Tori and I got into a huge blowout afterwards, which only served to prove them right. I mean, you got my family believing that I'm dumb. You going to New York every day and you still got nothing to show for it. I gotta take the car to work, so now you're hurting my career too. I didn't have a leg to stand on. The next morning, I brought her car to the body shop and I gathered every cent I had. And a lot of cents that I didn't have, because I had to pay for the repairs. Chapter 45. What happens here doesn't normally happen to winners, which in a sense means I won. I was so broke after covering tourist car repairs that I had to pawn my stuff to make rent money. Sadly, I had nothing of value to pawn except my CDs and my DVD collection, for which I received $80. It was movie-less nights for a while after that. I was still struggling in New York, but Keith continued to warm up to me. "You're doing better, Kevin," he said after one of my sets of stand-up New York. "The material isn't personal enough yet, but it's getting stronger. I think you're ready to audition for Lucian." Lucian Hold was a legend. He was the owner and booker of the comic strip on the Upper East Side. Every great comedian from Chris Rock to Jerry Seinfeld had gone through the same audition with him on the road of making it. For Eddie Murphy, passing his audition with Lucian was the first big break in his career. When I arrived a couple weeks later for my audition, the host told me how the process worked. I performed on stage for Lucian and the audience. Afterward, Lucian would call me into the back room, share his thoughts on the set, then let me know whether I passed or failed. Fortunately, I had an unbelievable set that night. I was on fire. The audience exploded. The room was destroyed. Any other violent comedy metaphors you can imagine, they happen. For an art form that's about making people happy, comedy really does have a lot of unhappy imagery about the things that people don't want in their lives. No one ever says, "I tickled the audience," or "I made the building turn gold." It just doesn't happen. After Lucian called me into the back room, he had a pencil mustache, a thin frame, and pale skin, as if he lived in a club that never saw sunlight. I joined him, excited to get feedback from the legend himself. He sat me down, adjusted his shirt, and spoke. "Kevin, I watched you, and I don't think this is for you." I could barely get the next words out. What do you mean? "I don't think stand-up comedy is for you." I didn't get it. I mean, the jokes didn't resonate for me. I stared at him, dumbfounded. I've been watching comedy for some time, and I've seen the best of the best. I've seen them all, and I just don't see it in you. I stuttered something incomprehensible. I mean, how could it be that the audience was laughing so much if I wasn't any good? It just didn't seem possible unless I was somehow misperceiving things from the stage. "I'm just being honest and straight up rather than holding things back," he continued. "I don't want you to waste your time. Maybe you should start looking into other things, finding different interests that suit you better. I think it would be very valuable to you at this point." In that moment, man, I felt my heart drop to my chest, splat onto the seat and slide onto the floor under Lucian's feet as he stomped on it. His words cut deeper than any insult I experienced before. If he'd been racist, at least I could have understood where the hate was coming from. It wouldn't have been personal to me as an individual, but about something I couldn't control. But this was specifically about my talent, or lack thereof. It was personal. I mean, my whole comedy life passed before my eyes. The first open mic winning, blazing Thursdays, quitting my job, telling my mom my life plan, traveling around Philly with Teray, Keith telling me to change my name, and all long drives to New York. Was all that just a waste of time? I was so confused. I mean, everyone else seemed to be giving me a positive response. Maybe I had overestimated my talent once again. If comedy wasn't in my future, then I had no future. There was nothing else I wanted to do. I couldn't go back to selling sneakers. On the other hand, what kind of person has the audacity to tell someone to give up their dream? Maybe I just wasn't the type of comic that he liked. Maybe he was having a bad day. He could have just said, "You're not right for this club," instead of saying, "Give it up forever." I didn't get angry at him. I didn't tell him he was wrong or cuss him out or defend myself. I just said, "Okay, thank you." And I shook his hand and left. Took the subway to the Comedy Cellar, found Keith, told Keith what happened. "Well, fuck Lucian. So what?" "I don't know, man. It was harsh. Shit hurt a little." "Get thicker skin then, stupid." "What are you gonna do? You gonna bitch about it?" "No, I just thought that we could talk about it." "Shut up. Stop being a bitch. Get your dumb ass up." "Okay. Don't you got a spot tonight? Go get on stage, man. I'll see you later. Yeah, I just need to get back out there, right? Don't give up and all that. End on a high. Stop blubbering about it, dummy. Just go do it. I walked to the Boston Comedy Club, got on stage, and bombed. Jesus Christ. Felt like I'd been kicked in the back of the head by 10 kids, then shit on by a flock of birds. I couldn't have felt any more humiliated as I drove Keith back to Philly at night. Look, Keith explained. He's stretching out in the back seat. You have people who understand what you're doing right away, and you got people who won't get it until everyone else does. That's just the way it is. To succeed, you have to see how good you are capable of becoming before anybody else sees it. I'm one of those people to see it. And that's all you need. Just a couple of people backing you who believe in you. He spoke almost the whole ride home, lifting me up. He told me that when he auditioned at the comic strip, even though he passed, Lucia told him that there were too many black people in the comedy club and no one was looking for more. And when Sam Kinison auditioned there, Lucia told him that there were too many white people in the comedy club and his act was never going to work. Kinison went on to become one of the most famous comedians in the 80s. It ain't going to happen overnight, Keith went on. It takes time. So until it happens, don't fucking bitch about it. Be a man. Have a man's intuition about taking care of business and go do what you're supposed to do, which is work on your shit. Goddamn. You're right. That's what I finally said. If it weren't for the talk that I had with Keith in the car that night, I don't know what I would have done. I might have given up, at least for a little while. But instead, you know what I did? Kept going back to New York and working harder. I was eventually booked at every other club in the city, but I never went back to the comic strip. Chapter 46. The struggle is even more real when people are laughing at you. In the wake of Lucian's rejection, I became a little more sensitive to criticism. I mean, when the guys at the Comedy Cellar called me a hack and slow every day, it started to get to me. It took me a while to remember that it was a compliment to be harassed by the comics I respected. They wouldn't be doing it if they didn't see potential in me. Keith wouldn't be spending all his time with me if he didn't feel the same. I just needed to get better and get better faster. Determined to prove Lucian wrong and to shut the other comics up, I became stronger and more dogged. The guys at the Comedy Cellar started calling me Mission Man because I worked like I was on a mission. Since showing off, bragging, or egotistical behavior of any kind was merciless savage at the table, I kept my excitement in check. Even when I was proud of myself for a new booking or a good show. Instead, I cut myself down before they could get to me or just roll good naturally with the punches. Some people make fun of you because it makes them feel better about themselves. Others make fun of you to make you a better person. These comedians all belong to the latter category. Eventually, they set up something called hack court. They put someone's joke on trial, and if it was found guilty of hackery, they'd all work to hack-proof it. The comedians there, I mean, they felt like they were doing important work. And the more they drank, the more passionate they became. They were the drunk knights of the dirty table. And their quest was not just to improve each other's material, but to elevate the art of comedy. Buried occasionally among a thousand snaps was a genuine compliment. One night, Jerry Seinfeld sauntered into a room and Colloquin said, "Hey, come here, Jerry. Meet Kevin Hart. The son of a bitch is funny." I coasted on that for the next 6 months. When Chris Rock walked in one night and Tracy Morgan dropped by the next day, I was introduced as a guy with a lot of potential. These compliment islands made the ocean of invective easier to take because I knew that at heart, they saw me as one of their own. I'd been accepted onto the Comedy Division One team, maybe as a bench warmer, but at least I had a shot at playing. But then in the midst of feeling good about myself and my future, I fell asleep at the wheel of a new Jeep that Tori had just leased with the help of her parents. Smashed it up good, too. After I managed to pay for the repairs and asked to use it again, Tori lectured me. "You keep falling asleep and wrecking my cars. It's about time you got your own car." She stepped closer to me and thrust her face into mine. "Well, that's right. You can't afford it. You're saying that we got to figure this out and figure that out before we move in together. Meanwhile, your rent isn't paid on time. The bills are late and that one's overdue. The fuck is going on? How is it possible for you to go back and forth so much and not bring any money back? Who are you up there with?" Her logic was as follows. If Kevin is going to New York every night to work and coming home at the crack of dawn with no money, is Kevin really working? Probably not. He's seeing someone else up there. And in a sense, I was. New York was my mistress. But I wasn't sleeping with nobody up there. I didn't have the time to. Hey, look, I'm with you, and only you, 100%. That's what I reassured her. But this is my life. Either you're on board with it, or you're not. But I gotta do the stuff that I want to make it. The more I tried to explain the situation to her, the less she understood. I had to leave for New York soon, with or without the car. So eventually, I just said, you know what, I gotta go. So if you still feel like you don't trust me, then come with me tonight and see what it's all about. That was what you call a bad decision, people. See, in my mind, I thought she'd see for herself that I was moving forward in my career. She'd see me getting recognized at the big comedy club. She'd see me being accepted by successful comedians. She'd see me making a name for myself in the city. In the city of, if I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. But I didn't consider the fact that I wasn't performing on that particular night. I was only networking and promoting my upcoming shows. So from Tori's perspective, the fact that everyone knew me at the clubs just meant I was a club rat. The fact that I was sitting at a table getting drunk with a bunch of comedians just meant I was an alcoholic. It looked like I was having a good time partying in New York. Like I was choosing to go out with the guys every night rather than be with her. On the way home, she was annoyed. You call that the struggle? Looked like a good time to me. You should have come up on the day when I was performing. That's what I tried to explain to her. I said, what you saw was me building relationships, me getting people to come to my shows, me doing what I had to do to get into these comedy clubs. That's bullshit, Kevin. You're all sitting there drinking and laughing all night, and you don't get on stage one time? At least at home, you're performing and working and making money. I don't know what you think you're doing there, but I know what you're not doing there. Putting time into our relationship. And that was that. After that, she never let me use her car again. Chapter 47. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. Which makes me wonder whether tough people should leave or stay when things get hard. I did both. So what I'm saying is that either way, I'm tough. In the past, I wasn't able to use Tori's car. It wasn't too big of a deal. I could take the bus to City Line Avenue and then I would ride with Keith. Sometimes he'd even pick me up. But now I had my own shows. There were nights when Keith wasn't going to New York and I had to make it up there on my own. The Amtrak train was too expensive, so I had to catch the Greyhound or the Peter Pan bus. I mean, which could take as long as 6 hours round trip. It would have been easy to just not go to New York when I didn't have a ride. But I refused to get lackadaisical. I had no room to be comfortable or slack off. I felt an obligation to Keith because he'd invested so much time in me. I had seen Big J and other people drop off, and I didn't want that to happen to me. Just like in Philadelphia, I found the underground rooms and the urban nights in New York. I started doing it all. But now my goal wasn't for people to laugh, like it had been when I started comedy, but it was for them to understand who they were laughing at. I was still working toward conveying more authenticity and relatability on stage. See, some black comics at the time were picky about the rooms they played. Now, I ain't going to that white shit. A lot of white comics were the same. Now, I ain't messing with that black shit. And a lot of people of all colors would say, I'm making money over here. I'm not going over there to perform in front of food. Hell no. I'm above that. Because my goal was to appeal to everyone so I could sell out the big theaters like the Def Comedy Jam Tour did, I played the rooms that were frowned upon by other comics. My job was to make all kinds of people laugh. So any place where there were people was my home. My thought was, New York is so big and there's so many places to perform spread out across the city and beyond, why not just do them all? I never turned down anything. Sometimes I got sent away. Sometimes I got burnt. Sometimes I traveled 7 hours to do a college show where no one laughed and I wasn't paid. But not once could anyone say that I didn't try. The comics who made it from that time were the ones who felt the same way and thought, I'm not above this place or these people. No one is. I'm here to get on stage, any stage. See, if you grind without that mentality, then you're wasting your time. Over time, because I never said no, the bookers took a liking to me. Most exciting of all, Esty at the Comedy Cellar let me MC on a peak night. I tried hard not to let these small steps go to my head because I saw other comedians mistaking success at local clubs for fame. They mistake familiarity, like the waitress and the valets knowing who they were, for popularity. If they went across the river to another borough, they'd be in trouble. Eventually, I started getting paid in something besides food for the most of my New York shows. Though the money wasn't as good as it had been in Philadelphia, at some shows, I'd make as little as $5. Other spots were $25. And on a good night with multiple sets, I'd end up with $70 in my pocket. The end game was to add up what I was making that month and make sure I could pay my rent, utilities, transportation, and food. Eventually, I got a big break financially, and it came from a Philadelphia comic, Buck Wild. He was stepping down as a host of Saturday Night Show just off the strip of Atlantic City and offered me the opportunity to take over. It paid $175 each week, which would allow me to cover my rent every month and have $150 to spare. It was my first chance to run a room and book the talent. So I was excited to help out newer comedians, just as Teray and Keith had done for me. So many guys I looked up to, like Donnell Rawlings, Rob Stapleton, they were running rooms in the underground comedy scene, and they had given them flexibility to perform anywhere. The opportunity seemed like a dream come true, until I arrived and saw pretty quickly why Buck Wild had quit. The club was called Sweet Cheeks. As I should have extrapolated from the name, it was a male review. However, the strippers would leave, and then it would turn into what the owners called a nightclub, but in reality, it was a hood bar. When I arrived the first night, the place was thugged the fuck out with dudes partying, fighting, playing pool, preparing to destroy comedians. My introduction was the DJ announcing over the sound system, "That's enough! Time for us to start the comedy show." Then the music stopped, and I was expected to somehow get everyone's attention and respect. All I said was, "Hi, I'm Kevin Hart," and the yelling began. "Stand up, Kevin, go the fuck home. Hey, fuck you, man." My heart froze. This was a whole club full of guys like the Richard Allen hecklers. I wasn't going to be able to get a single joke out, so I just introduced the next comic and cleared off the stage. He tried to push through his planned material, despite the heckling, and got destroyed by the audience. He didn't even finish the set. I forced a smile onto my face, walked back out, and tried to do something like the speech I'd given the Richard Allen thugs, acknowledging the truth of the situation. I thought that would go over well, but less than a minute into it, a voice boomed through the room. "Nah, man, enough!" I looked to my right to see a bald, bearded giant holding a buffalo wing. He took a bite out of it, I guess so he wouldn't waste it all, then he threw it at me and sat down. It hit me all saucy on the side of my face. I could feel it bounce off my cheek, leaving a burning red mark of chickeny shame. Oh, I was furious. "Stand back up," that's what I yelled at him. "You think just because I'm up here telling jokes, I ain't no man? I'm a man first." "You ain't no man, you a chicken," someone called out. "Oh, this is stupid." That's what I yelled. I yelled that out stupidly. "Us people gotta stick together, man." I was trying to save face up there. "That's the problem with us black people. We don't stick together." Thought that would get me some sympathy. It didn't. I just walked off stage. I ain't even introduced the next comic. He just went on himself, petrified. I just sat there watching him get obliterated. I couldn't believe that I had lost my cool and my composure. I didn't want to go back the next week and face that crowd again. But I remembered that the point of doing Underground Club was to learn to survive any situation. And if I could survive this, then I could definitely survive anything. Now that I knew what I was getting into, I had time to plan for it. An audience this crazy didn't have the patience for jokes. It wasn't about doing a tight five here. It was about survival. And that was familiar to me, because it was exactly what we did at the table. I just had to pretend like I was at the Comedy Cellar and be aware that the Sweet Cheeks regulars were testing me. If I could talk shit back to them and hold my own without buckling, then they'd accept me. It was just a game of snaps. 100 against 1. Once you know the rules of the game, you can play it. If you don't know the rules, you'll always lose. My friend Naeem was trying to make inroads in New York, so I keeped him, and I asked him to drive me to Sweet Cheeks for my next performance. I did a few early shows in New York, and then after that, we drove to Atlantic City. On the way, Naeem asked me what I thought of his act. "It was funny," I said. "I'm just parroting Keith." "You just got to make your stuff more personal, more about you. Let people know who Naeem is." We arrived at Sweet Cheeks during a review, and I met with the other comics. As a host, I had a responsibility to let them know how the room worked, which is more like a cage match in the comedy club. "Look, just go up there," I explained. "All I need is for you to do your time. Good or bad, it don't matter. Just hang in there. Whatever happens, happens. Get your money. If you do that, I can keep the room full, and you can keep coming down." When the comedy show began, I was ready. As soon as the first thug's mouth opened, I went after him before he could finish what he was saying. "Man, shut up with that goddamn half a mile big head of yours." The relieving sound of laughter and damns filled the room, and I knew I could handle this. By the end of the night, I started to enjoy the verbal knife fight. Even when I got out-shouted or out-insulted, it felt like I was in my element. In one way or another, whether it was my mom, school bullies, or a swim team banquet, I'd been doing this my whole life. Eventually, Sweet Cheeks got so packed that I had enough leverage to switch the night to Wednesdays so I could perform the big weekend shows in New York. I was also able to get more money to bring in comedians I liked. I paid them as much as $250, making sure to always let them know that they were getting that much just to make up for the horrible experience they were going to have there. I can count on one hand the people who had successful sets in that room. There wasn't a night that went by without booing. However, just like at the table, I hung in there and I kept talking back until the regulars came to accept me and respect me. Performing today is easy in comparison with those shows like Sweet Cheeks, where the audiences didn't give a shit about me, where a bad joke would get me booed off stage, and sometimes even a good joke, and where I had to win over an audience that was there with the sole intention of humiliating me. The entertainer who chooses the easy road, lined with cheering fans offering flowers and likes, won't survive when the terrain gets challenging. The entertainer who chooses the hard road, lined with jeering haters throwing chicken wings, not only learns to survive any terrain, but to run even the easy road better than the competition. Chapter 48. When opportunity knocks, open the door, hear it out, then slam the door in its face if you don't like what it has to say. Here's the thing about performing live. If you do it enough, the right person will see you. One night at the Boston Comedy Club, a big executive on the scene named Barry Katz saw my set and said he wanted to meet with me. When I reconnected with Keith later that night, I asked him what he thought. He said, "Barry Katz? Yeah, he wants to meet with me. Oh man, he's one of the biggest comedy managers in New York. He's got Dave Chappelle, Jay Moore, Jim Brewer. You name big guys, Barry Katz has them." I took the meeting. It was my first. And it started off great. You know, I just sat there while he blew smoke up my ass. "Buddy, I think you're hysterical." That's what he told me. He said, "You're funny. You got it. I want to manage you." This was it. It's the first thing I thought. I'm like, the comedy industry had finally noticed the new guy and recognized his potential. It was the next step on the road to comedy stardom. I said, "All right, well, what do we do?" He said, "Just keep doing what you're doing and I'll take care of the rest. Think of it like a bucket of shit. I'll take it and throw it against the wall and see what sticks for you." Now, I was young, and I was inexperienced, and I definitely wasn't the smartest guy in the room. But I tell you what, I knew what shit was. And here was a man who wanted to manage me that was comparing my career, the one I'd begged my mom for money to help support and sacrificed all my time with my girlfriend and spent probably 1,000 hours going back and forth to New York for, to a bucket of shit? He was comparing all of that work, time, energy, and effort to a bucket of shit. Not a pile of shit. Not a piece of shit. A bucket. That means we're talking about a lot of shit. He put a lot of shit in a bucket, and that's what he was comparing my career towards. I left the meeting with a smile plastered on my face, then immediately spoke to Keith. "Man, that's no good." That's what Keith said. He thought about it for a moment and continued. "So I say, fuck Barry. You don't have the time for anybody who doesn't see what you have the potential to be. Don't do anything with him." I'd never turned down an opportunity before. In fact, the reason I'd done so much was precisely because I was waiting for a single opportunity like this one. And I didn't know when it was going to happen again. But I had to follow my gut. Even if Barry had and continues to have a great reputation, saying no to the biggest comedy manager in New York was one of the hardest things I had to do in my career. On paper, it seemed like the worst decision I could make. But from it, I learned that trusting your gut in situations where your logic contradicts you is terrifying, especially the first time you do it. But it's always the right move. I returned to New York City and became multiple set Kev. Some nights, I performed as many as 5 shows. I had to get a subway pass so I could haul ass from one gig to the next. And then one night, I got a second chance. This time, I was at the Comedy Cellar and Dave Attell caught my set. Attell was one of the funniest performers on the circuit. Every local comic looked up to him. He said, "Hey dude, man, I think you're extremely funny." That's what he said, randomly to me, after a show. Then he said to me, "Do you have a manager?" I was like, "No, I don't." He said, "I want my manager to come see you." Attell's manager, A big friendly dude who looked like a cross between a jock who'd smoked too much weed and an extra from Planet of the Apes came the next week. He introduced himself as Dave Becky, said he loved my set and set up a meeting at the place he worked. The place was called Three Arts Entertainment. He wasn't as hot of a manager as Katz at the time, but he was up and coming and well respected. I was relieved that I hadn't shut all the doors to my future by saying no to Katz. I came home excited about this second chance and asked Tori if I could just once borrow her car. I even promised to come home early since I didn't have any shows that night. Whatever, you're not going to go see no bitch in my truck. You go up there on your own. The meeting was at 4 p.m. But I was so worried about being late or something going wrong on the way that I planned to leave that morning at 10. My friends were baffled that I was taking this meeting so seriously. Zach was like, what's it for, a job? I was like, no, it's just a meeting, man. I mean, I'm going to see what happens. It sound like a waste of time. No, it's not. This could be big. I mean, you never know. What if they cancel that shit? Just do it on another day when you gotta be in town anyway. Zach always wanted to schedule life at his convenience. And consequently, he had a reputation as someone who was irresponsible and whose word couldn't be trusted. I was learning to treat everything as if it were a high priority. Because the next meeting or show or dinner just might be the one where you get what you've been looking for. It just takes one person to say one thing and your whole life can change. If success happens in part by chance, then the more you expose yourself to it, the luckier you'll be. I worked hard in order to get lucky. And I was lucky the day I went to that meeting. I'd never been in a place like Dave Becky's office before. It felt like something out of a movie. We met in a big glass conference room, in a big glass building, at a big glass table surrounded by plush armchairs. It looked like the kind of place where the decisions that run the world get made. Dave, who always dressed like he was coming back from the beach, introduced me to a guy in a suit who seemed to be about my age, and he never spoke. I mean, even when I shook his hand, he didn't speak. They both sat, almost in unison, across the table from me. I felt both intimidated and excited. It's funny to remember how awed by this I was, because I've compared notes with other comedians, and no one has said that they were impressed by a conference room. What happens in here? I kept asking. Who else comes through here? Who? Wow. So what is Three Arts? I kind of knew what a manager was, and that this is someone who was supposed to get me more gigs and more money, but I had no idea what a management company was or what they did. My mind was reeling with questions. Am I starting to make it now? Is this how all the big stuff starts happening? What's the catch? Fortunately, Dave didn't call what I was doing shit. He called it a craft. One of the great things about working with someone young is that they're not jaded, bitter, or cynical. Dave said some of the same things that Barry did, but in words I could hear. He explained that my goal right now should be to keep working on my craft, and he would look up for opportunities and bring them to me. Now, I don't know what you've experienced in the past, he continued, but he said, with me, there's no paperwork, no contract. There's nothing binding you to me. We shake hands. If you believe in the things that I'm saying, then let me show you what I can do. If later on you don't feel like I'm doing enough for you or it's not working out between us, then you're entitled to leave. It's that simple. I mean, it made sense, and I couldn't see a downside. I didn't even have to pay him. He just took a percentage of pay from the work that he bought in. Okay, I told him. I don't have a manager, so I guess I have a manager. He smiled. We shook hands. What are the next steps? I asked. He said, just keep getting stronger in comedy. The best way to get the right people's attention is to hone your craft. Your stand-up is going to open up all the doors you need. I walked out of his office into the busy, nobody saying hello, strangers won't even give you direction street in New York. And it felt weird. I was a professional comedian with a big-time manager now. I had thought I would feel different, but it was more like losing your virginity. Everyone says it's such a big deal, and it will make you a man, but afterwards you're still you. You look the same, you talk the same, you have the same amount of money in the bank. Or maybe you'll pick leaves out of your hair. Hope Miss Davis didn't see you. Go back to your mom's house. Either way, nothing's different. I decided to stay in New York that evening. I walked around the city until the comedy clubs opened. Then I went to the shows, sat in the back, talked to other comics, and caught the last bus home. I kept waiting for lightning to strike me or a marching band to start playing, but nothing happened. The only thing that changed after the meeting was that every week or two, Dave would call to check in and ask how things were going. It was nice to have someone whose job it was to care. If I complained, he simply said, you just keep getting out there. So I just kept hustling and booking those rooms. Do you have any spots? Can I do your room? How do I get an audition? Can I start a night here? More often than not, I eventually got those spots, those rooms, those auditions, and those nights. And so I was going to New York every day. I was successful, not because I was the most talented person they'd seen, and not because I was the most persistent person they'd seen. I have no doubt that there were people more talented, more persistent, and harder working than me. But there was one other thing that gave me the winning edge, and will always give you the winning edge. It was being likable. No person succeeds alone. Success is a community effort. The more relationships you have, the better you'll be able to survive, thrive, and grow. A lot of times I've seen people booked for parts on TV shows and films who weren't the best actors, but everyone liked them, was treated well by them, and knew they'd enjoy having them on set. I pride myself on being a good guy. There's no bullshit with me. When negative shit comes my way, I try to bat it back with positivity. I haven't always succeeded, but I've eventually learned from my mistakes. It's not a technique I use. It's the way I was raised. My mother worked hard to make sure I had a good heart, that I wasn't an animal, that I didn't treat other people like objects. No one is above anybody and no one is below anybody. That's what she taught me. So if you're treating people any other way, you're out of line with reality. And always respecting and acknowledging people as equals and going through their own struggles, whether the status in the room was higher or lower than mine, I noticed a side effect. Eventually, I wasn't grinding alone anymore. Comedians, bookers, bartenders, and waiters, they all started telling me about openings and opportunities. In most action movies, one person rises out of a humble beginning to discover that they have been chosen by destiny to save the world. But that's not how it works in real life. You rise out of your humble beginning to become a part of a community. And it is only together and as equals that we will save the world. Life lessons from transition. The toughest transition is the transition to understanding that being yourself is all you need to be. Chapter 49, in which I discover that I'm not actually as good as I thought, which then puts me onto the path to becoming as good as I thought. It was the biggest comedy festival on the planet. Just for Laughs in Montreal. I mean, the entire comedy industry would be there. Not just promoters and bookers, but television network executives and film casting agents. Just being on the bill was enough to generate buzz in the business. But a great performance could make a comedian's career, even get them their own TV pilot. Scouts for the festival saw me perform in New York and offered me a slot on their New Faces showcase. I called Dave breathlessly and told him the big news. I'd never been out the country before. His response is, "You're not ready." "Huh?" "You're not ready, Kevin. All right, we're going to pass this one up." "What? Wait, no, man. This is the biggest shit ever, dude. What are you talking about? Come on. Look, come into the office. We can talk about it." I decided to ask Keith for his opinion. If he agreed with Dave, then maybe I'd actually have to pass on this. He didn't agree. He said, "Stupid, that's the biggest showcase out there. That's where you get a deal. That's where they give you some money. And you telling me that he said what? He wants me to turn it down." Keith couldn't wrap his head around it. "Look, stupid, I think that you should definitely do it. But the comedians who work with Dave Becky all say he knows what he's doing. So you got to make your own call on this one." I had no other opportunities in my career at the moment besides this festival performance. So I stormed into Dave's office, ready to make my case. He sat me down and calmly explained that I was still too green. "You only get one shot at this festival to make your presence known," he elaborated. "They want to put you on a New Faces showcase, so all the studios, all the agencies, all the casting agents, everybody is going to see you. And for the first time they see you, they need to be blown away, Kevin. Take a year and work on your material to make sure that you stand out from the pack. Then when you go next year, then they'll be fighting over you." I stood staring at him with my jaw open, processing his words. They stung a lot. I wanted to say that with him or without him, I was gone. But he was highly respected, and I had gotten this far by listening to the advice of people like him, even when I didn't agree with their logic. I said, "Are you sure?" He said, "A year go by like that." He snapped his fingers. "Okay." It was one of the toughest okays that I'd ever spoken. Then I thought, shit, what if they don't invite me back next year? It was a good thing I waited, because later that week I did a show at the Comedy Cellar with the material that had gotten me the Just for Laughs offer. I asked Keith to take a hard look at my set. Let me know if I needed to improve so I could stand out at the Just for Laughs for following year. I still thought it was my best stuff, until I sat down next to Keith at the table. Good set, man. Thanks. Nah, I killed it. Yeah, hey, who was the midget robber you were talking about? Oh, I made it up. Oh, okay. Hey, you know that whole bit about you and a dirty sock and the dirty sock is talking? Hey, when did a dirty sock talk to you?